Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update, this week on your free iHeartRadio app.
In retrospect, revisit pop culture moments from the 80s and 90s and try to understand what it taught us about the world and a woman's place in it. Crying in public. Two 20-something college women living in NYC dive into growing up at a time when there was no distinction between what's public and what's private. Best of Both Worlds, a discussion on work-life balance, career development, parenting, time management, productivity, and making time for fun.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Early on the morning of June 15th, 1979, Amir Zeta was driving home from partying with friends when his car got stuck in an embankment down near the Hudson River waterfront in Nyack, New York. Amir called a friend from a payphone to help him secure a tow truck. While he waited in the darkened parking lot of a nearby restaurant, he heard a strange noise coming from behind a dumpster.
It was a growl, like a gruff growling noise. I didn't want to go in the corner, but at the same time, I was saying, like, you know, well, whatever is going on over there, like, you know, don't be a punk. Go over there and check it out.
What he saw there shocked and terrified him. But before he could react, police cars were on the scene, sirens blaring.
Two police officers threw me down, handcuffed me behind my back, searched me, and then they put me in the back of the car. Just that quick.
Amir was arrested and charged with sexual assault and the brutal murder of a young local woman, Shirley Smith, the woman he had found lying behind a dumpster, covered in blood, and had tried to help.
My name is Amir Zeta. I did 41 years in prison for a crime that I didn't commit.
From Lava for Good, this is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Today, Amir Zeta.
I'm an Arab American. I was born in Nyack Hospital in Rockland County, New York.
Amir Zeta was born in 1961 into a large, loving family.
My mother and father are from Jordan. They immigrated to the United States in 1958. At the time, it was my eldest brother, Nazar, eldest sister, Nazira, and the two twins, Samira and Samira, who were my next oldest. And then myself, I'm the baby of the family.
Growing up, Amir didn't feel any different from the other kids at school. But when he was 5 or 6 years old, something happened that changed the way others saw his family and the way he felt about himself.
My father got a dispute with a neighbor over property. Apparently, my father didn't speak English that well. And they ended up calling the police officer. The police officer ended up getting a glass cut on the back of his hand. But at the time, they maintained that he had been shot by my father. It wasn't the case, but I still have the memories, too, of being a six-year-old kid sitting in my father's attempted a murder on a police officer's trial and how it affected me, and then how it affected me through my school years from that point on about being called the murderer's, the cop killer's son, even though there was no police officer killed or even shot.
The charge against his father was dismissed. But from that time on, Amir says his family was treated differently by the police.
They started going after my family in a methodical manner, for my eldest brother, then my next brother and me. My eldest sister left out of the county. She seen the writing on the wall, and she took off. She got married and left the county.
Amir's other sister, Samira, was deported to the Middle East and later died from a medical issue that Amir believes could have been easily treated in the United States. His brother, Samir, ended up serving nearly 42 years in prison and was also deported upon his release. Despite his family's troubles, Amir found a bright spot in all of this darkness.
I knew Amir from the time I was like in grammar school, and I always knew Amir had a crush on me. So we were like, what, maybe 12 years old?
This is Bonnie McKenna, but when Amir met her in seventh grade, she was Bonnie Stalter.
We shared an art class, I believe in a music class at the school. I used to always sit at the table with her in the class and, you know, spend more time paying attention to her than I was to class. And then one day I took a chance and I walked up to her when we were at the lockers.
And he's like, Bonnie Sue Stalter. And he like just takes me and he flings me up against the locker and he starts kissing me.
And I kissed her, man.
He like stole the kiss from me, his first kiss from me. And we have like connected ever since that moment on.
Amir soon went away to military academy, but he never forgot that first kiss. A year and a half later, he came back to Nyack to register for high school.
She was the first person I seen. She was actually outside the school. And I was in the military academy. I still had my uniform on. And she was the first beautiful face that I seen. And then from there, we just reignited the flame that, you know, has been lit for quite a while. And, you know, I've always felt like I loved her.
So I didn't have the perfect life. My life was very complicated as a child. And I was a runaway. And I wound up with Mr. and Mrs. Zeta.
Bonnie moved in with Amir's family when she was 15. They gave her a stable home. And she says his parents treated her like a princess. By then, she and Amir were inseparable.
He was the most gentlest, kindest person I ever met. And we had a good time together, you know, in the 70s. We were just bopping around, you know, being kids, having a good time.
But those good times would soon come to an end. And Amir's troubles with the police were about to begin.
He was 17 years old in June of 1979, and the night that this crime happened, he and his friends went out drinking and partying. You know, they were out all night.
This is Arthur Larkin of the law firm Hale & Monaco, Amir's post-conviction attorney.
And the last 5 years, I'm representing plaintiffs in civil rights cases, including people like Amir Zeta, who've been wrongfully convicted of crimes and are seeking to overturn their convictions.
So, Arthur, can you walk us through what happened that night, June 15th, 1979?
Amir was driving. He admits he was drinking. He bought Quaaludes at Joseph Lenti's deli. He bought a couple of magazines, and he bought Quaaludes. So, as the night's coming to a close, he's driving around the town after he dropped all his friends off and he starts driving home. He took a right turn down, I believe it's Gedney Street, and he turned off the street onto a sort of a dirt area, an embankment adjacent to the Windjammer parking lot. And his car got stuck.
The Windjammer restaurant was located at the foot of Main Street on the Hudson River waterfront. After trying unsuccessfully to free his car from the embankment, Amir walked to a phone booth and called his friend John Nash to tell him he needed a tow truck. John offered to call around looking for one, and after making a couple of calls, he left to pick Amir up.
And Amir had told him in the phone call, Amir had said, listen, just meet me in the Windjammer parking lot. That's where my car is. It's adjacent. After Amir hangs up the phone, he goes down back to his car. He tries to drive it again. He can't. He wanders down to the parking lot. And as he's walking through the parking lot, he hears a sound.
It was a growl, like a gruff growling noise. I was reluctant to actually even walk into that area because it was dark. it was completely pitch black. There was a garbage dumpster there. The trees were hanging over the top. I had fear. I didn't want to go in the corner, but at the same time, I was saying, like, well, whatever is going on over there, like, don't be a punk. Go over there and check it out. I approached slowly. And when I first looked, I seen that there was something at the dumpster, but I wasn't sure what it was.
A young woman was lying face down behind the dumpster, her clothes in shreds. She was nearly naked and had been stabbed multiple times.
He leans over and he tries to lift her up. Oh my God, are you okay?
That's when I noticed, who that was.
The woman was 17-year-old Shirley Smith. Amir recognized her because he'd gone to school with her cousin, but he didn't know Shirley well.
By the time I had stepped up, discovered the victim, and attempted to try to help her, to give her assistance, I heard the Nyack police car pulling down the street.
Amir looks up. He sees a police car. He's standing over a body. His family has had trouble with the police before. Okay, so Amir immediately runs. He's scared and he runs.
Officers John McCord and James Thurston were the first ones on the scene. When they spotted Amir crouched next to the body, they immediately ran for him.
The two police officers threw me down, handcuffed me behind my back, threw me over the back of the police car, searched me, took everything out of my pockets and put it in the police officer's hat. And then they put me in the back of the car. Just that quick.
And that's so fast. I mean, did you even register what was happening at that point?
I knew something was wrong. There was someone there, but I didn't realize the extent as far as my involvement. I just walked up on it just that quick.
They put him in the back seat of the car and they go to the victim and they try to revive her. The victim is very bloody and they're trying to, they're trying to do CPR, but she's pronounced dead at the scene, unfortunately.
At that point, another officer, Michael Roman, had arrived. The policeman pulled Amir back out of the car, patrol car number 383, to frisk him.
Now, keep in mind, they've been touching the victim's body, so their hands are bloody. They weren't wearing gloves. And they don't find a murder weapon on Amir.
They took me up in the patrol car. They transported me up to Nyack Police Station. And then later on that morning, I went before, I believe it was Judge McCarthy, and he arraigned me without bail and charged me with second-degree murder and remanded me to the Rockland County Jail.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Truck stop brothels run by a web of ex-cons. A Commonwealth attorney wasted on whiskey and power. Protection exchanged for cash and flesh. This is Hooker Game, Criminals and Libertines in the South. And I am your host, Dr. Lindsay Byron. 3 years ago, I came across a goldmine of news clippings detailing a scandal that rocked my small southern hometown. As I flipped through each page, this forgotten story came back to life.
I was told that it was just supposed to be a massage parlor.
The big shot in Davo was Barker.
He beats me continuously.
If you print anything that you hear in that grand jury, you will be put in jail.
I never gave any massages.
Listen to Hooker Gay, Criminals and Libertines in the South on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update, this week on your free iHeartRadio app.
In retrospect, revisit pop culture moments from the 80s and 90s and try to understand what it taught us about the world and a woman's place in it. Crying in public. Two 20-something college women living in NYC dive into growing up at a time when there was no distinction between what's public and what's private. Best of Both Worlds, a discussion on work-life balance, career development, parenting, time management, productivity, and making time for fun.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I honestly believed that the truth would come out. I did not realize the extent that they were going to go to make me look guilty.
So Arthur, Shirley Smith's body has been found. She's apparently been sexually assaulted and stabbed to death, but no weapon is recovered, and Amir is the number one suspect. So can you tell us about the investigation that followed? What did police reports say?
The police's version of events is that they pulled into the parking lot after they received a call about screams and dogs barking in the vicinity of the Windjammer parking lot. They say that when they got to the scene, they saw a pair of legs protruding from behind a dumpster with the underwear and pants down. And they said that pair of legs was Amir Zeta's and that Amir was trying to sexually assault the victim.
Officers McCord and Thurston claimed that when they came upon Amir, he wasn't wearing a shirt and that as they chased him, his pants were falling down. They said that when they cuffed him and put him in the car, his pants were still down.
And after they had attended to the victim and they opened the police car door to try to frisk him, his pants were miraculously pulled up and zipped up. Okay? So they frisk Amir and they find no murder weapon, nothing. There's some blood on his underwear, the back of his underwear. There's some blood in his front pants pocket, and there's a marijuana cigarette that they say they found in his pocket with blood on it. Later tests show that that blood matches the victim's blood. Now, no murder weapon was ever found at the scene.
Divers searched the nearby Hudson River, and detectives scoured the Windjammer parking lot. But no murder weapon was ever found. 2 days later, another officer, Douglas McDonnell, was driving the same patrol car, number 383. As McDonnell later testified, when he stopped to get gas, he ran into another officer who was doing the same, and the two started talking.
Now, the crime is on a Friday morning. This is now Sunday. And son of a gun, if both officers don't look in the back seat of the car and say, "Oh my goodness, there's a knife."
Remember, patrol car 383 had been searched thoroughly after Amir was picked up, and no knife had been found at the time. But now, this knife had somehow been discovered in the car's back seat. This was before DNA testing was available, but when tested, traces of blood found on the knife were shown to be consistent with Shirley Smith's genetic profile.
And the prosecution's theory at trial is that the knife was the murder weapon and that even though his hands were handcuffed behind his back, after the officers put him in the car, Amir Zeta had somehow managed to, wherever he had secreted the knife on his person, he managed to extract it, shove it under the seat somehow, and pull his pants up all in one shot. Okay?
There were no fingerprints on the knife, nothing that directly connected it to Amir. And the blood found on the knife could very well have gotten there the next day when Detective Arthur Keenan took it to New York City for testing, along with two vials of the victim's blood. But determined to hold on to their prime suspect, Amir, the police went looking for a witness to corroborate their theory.
They went to see Joe Lenti, who was known to be a local drug dealer and who had sold Amir the Quaaludes and the magazines the night before. Joe Lenti says, "Yeah, that's very similar to the knife that I sold Amir on Thursday night."
So the main evidence against you, allegedly, was this knife. Did you buy this knife? Was this knife yours?
I had no knife. The knife magically appeared.
The knife the cops said they found in the car was a black folding knife with the word leopard on the handle. When they went to see Joseph Lenti, they didn't show him this exact knife, but one that was very similar, a white-handled knife with a lion on the handle that Detective Keenan had found in a drawer at the police station. Joseph Lenti told police that he had bought 17 of these knives at a place called the Bronx Terminal Market.
And that he had sold them all 16 of them. Amir came in the night before the crime and bought the last of them, the 17th knife. And he had the receipt for $15 from Amir, but that was for the Quaaludes and the magazines. That wasn't for a knife.
Based on this knife that was found in the patrol car, the alleged murder weapon, which Amir had supposedly purchased from Joseph Lenti, and the fact that Amir was at the scene when police arrived, Amir was charged with second-degree murder, first-degree attempted sodomy, and aggravated criminal sexual abuse. His trial was set for 6 months later.
So did you always believe in his innocence, you know, back then when you guys were kids and he gets arrested? What were you thinking?
When that happened and I heard Mama downstairs and I heard her crying and screaming, I never in a thousand years thought that he had gotten arrested for such a crime or anything of that nature. And I lost a lot of friends over that. Because they were like, Bonnie, you know, your life's going to change. I didn't care that my life was going to change. I stayed beside him. I stuck by him. And I said, this is going to get better. I don't know why they're doing this. I don't know why it came to this point. But I honestly, Maggie, thought that this was going to get better, that they were going to find the real person that committed this crime. And that's what I kept thinking for all of these years.
Within a week following the crime, a grand jury was convened, and Amir gave testimony about the events of that night. Amir's trial began 6 months later on January 7th, 1980, in Rockland County Court before Judge Albert Rosenblatt. The prosecutor was Rockland County's first assistant district attorney, William Frank. Amir's defense attorney was William Kunstler.
The officers testified to finding the knife in the backseat of the car 2 days later. Joe Lenti testifies that he bought the knife at the Bronx Terminal Market.
The prosecution also presented a witness, Donald Lewis, someone who had gone to school with Shirley and knew Amir as well.
And he claimed that he saw Amir at a phone booth. And Amir turned and said to Shirley Smith, the victim, "Hey, Shirley, want to smoke a joint?" And Shirley said, "Sure." That was his testimony at trial.
Amir maintains that this encounter never happened. And in fact, Donald Lewis was later tape recorded telling an acquaintance that he had made the whole story up.
And Lewis said, "Listen, you know, I had a beef with him. Don't tell anybody. I didn't see him at a phone booth." In essence, what he said was his trial testimony was a lie, and he had that recorded.
After the trial, Amir tried to appeal his conviction based on that recorded confession. But at the hearing, Lewis changed his story again.
Instead of sticking by the recantation, Lewis said, "Yeah, I knew that he was recording me, and so we just orchestrated it." And the judge did not buy the recantation. He wouldn't accept it. And Amir's motion was denied. I think the police probably got to him and said, "Look, you better stick to your story."
And that's because, as it turned out later, Lewis was facing criminal charges in another matter, and thus highly incentivized to incriminate Amir. By sticking to his story that he'd seen Amir and Shirley together, he was able to avoid prosecution. So Arthur, the defense did not know that at the time. It wasn't disclosed by the prosecution. So what was the defense that Amir's attorneys presented?
You know, Kunstler did a pretty good job tracking down the witnesses who confirmed Amir Zeta's version of events. His friend John Nash testified. John Nash's mother, Catherine, testified that Amir had called the house at 4 o'clock in the morning. Kunstler got phone records from the phone company showing that a call was made from a payphone in Nyack on Broadway to Nash's house at 4 a.m. Phone records showing that Nash had called for a tow truck at 4:15 and 4:14 a.m., right? Just as he testified and just as Amir said that his friend told him he would.
John testified that he had driven down to the waterfront that night, but his own car broke down, and when he couldn't locate a mirror, he called a taxi to take him home. And John's version of events matches up with the testimony that Amir gave at the earlier grand jury hearing.
Amir testified in his own defense, and so the jury had Amir's version of what happened. And his explanation, as I just said, is backed up by witnesses and by telephone records and by the business records of this Bud's taxi, right? But it didn't matter to the jury. The jury credits the officer's version of events, and they convict him.
It was surreal. I guess the first time the reality of my situation hit me, dawned on me, was the day of my sentencing when they gave me 25 to life. I just fell apart. I just started crying. I couldn't believe. I can still feel that feeling right now in my heart as to what they did to me and how it felt. You know, they took my life away. I still could not understand what motivated them to want to do what they did to me.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
iHeart Podcast Update, this week on your free iHeart Radio app.
In retrospect, revisit pop culture moments from the 80s and 90s and try to understand what it taught us about the world and a woman's place in it. Crying in public. Two 20-something college women living in NYC dive into growing up at a time when there was no distinction between what's public and what's private. Best of Both Worlds, a discussion on work-life balance, career development, parenting, time management, productivity, and making time for fun. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Truck stop brothels run by a web of ex-cons. A Commonwealth attorney wasted on whiskey and power. Protection exchanged for cash and flesh. This is Hooker Game, Criminals and Libertines in the South. And I am your host, Dr. Lindsay Byron. 3 years ago, I came across a goldmine of news clippings detailing a scandal that rocked my small southern hometown. As I flipped through each page, this forgotten story came back to life.
I was told that it was just supposed to be a massage parlor.
The big shot in Danville was Barker.
He beats me continuously.
If you print anything that you hear in the grand jury, you will be put in jail.
I never gave any massages.
Listen to Hooker Gay, Criminals and Libertines in the South on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We always believed, you know, like the truth will prevail. And once I got convicted, we believed that when we filed the appeal, you know, that I would win the appeal and it would be all be put in the past. And then we can go on with our lives. And then as time started to go by, reality set in. I was in prison. There wasn't really much I can do. I've been assaulted, abused while I was incarcerated by staff. I'm missing a bone in my right shoulder where I was jumped by 7 officers and the sergeant in Attica and brutally beaten. That's a type of treatment that's like a regular thing. That's kind of like expected, as they say, for people with the type of crime that I was convicted of. They thought it was their privilege to abuse people that were incarcerated for the type of crime I was incarcerated for.
You mean like a sex offense?
A sex offense, yeah. The corrections officers took it upon themselves to, you know, just hurt people that had cases like mine, yeah. They thought it was funny, you know? I guess they thought it was their place in life to get revenge for the victims.
Amir and Bonnie had gotten married in 1980, before he went to prison. She continued to believe in him and to visit regularly. They were allowed conjugal visits, and in 1981, their son Amir Jr. was born. In 1988, they had a second son, Jameer.
You know, I'm sure if things had went better, we would have had more children.
We had the two boys, and it was becoming complicated. I mean, I always thought that things were going to change, you know, because he was innocent. I thought that tomorrow he's going to get out. Tomorrow things are going to change.
So what did you tell your kids over the years with their dad in prison?
That he was always innocent. That, you know, when they were little, that was hard to tell them things like that, you know. But they always heard the same thing over and over. So they always believed in his innocence. I mean, I didn't want to get into the gory parts of it. You know, it's not something you really want to discuss. But the kids were being subjected to things they shouldn't have, Maggie.
She had two sons to raise. And she had a life of her own that she had to live. So it became difficult for her.
Eventually, Bonnie and Amir made the difficult decision to divorce. Bonnie later remarried and had a third son, Connor.
She did what she had to do, and I respected that. It broke my heart. But the thing is though, even though she went on and made a life for herself, I was still always a part of her life, and she was still there for me.
Amir filed a number of appeals between 1987 and 2000, but his conviction was upheld in every case. He went up for parole 7 times, but was denied each time because he refused to admit guilt for the murder. The parole board has since relaxed its requirement that defendants admit guilt in order to be eligible. And finally, in February of 2018, after serving almost 40 years of his sentence, Amir was granted parole. But his incarceration didn't end there.
I wasn't released for 2 more years because parole sabotaged my release.
He couldn't find suitable housing. And the reason for that is he's got a sex offense as part of his conviction. And there are restrictions on where he can live.
My family, my son were attempting to get me a place to stay. But I also still went through trouble because every time my family rented a place with the New York State law, with the registry, you have to inform the landlord as to what you're incarcerated for.
Finally, Amir was able to find a housing situation that satisfied the parole board, and he was officially released in 2021. But the charges and the restrictions remain on his record.
You're still a registered sex offender right now. You have not been cleared of that.
No, I haven't been cleared of anything yet. So I am a level 3, and I'm basically under house arrest.
So, after Jesus, I don't know how many years, we got back together again. I never stopped loving him, and I never stopped believing in him.
Amir is now living with Bonnie, whose husband, Brian McKenna, passed away in 2021. Amir is able to spend time with his sons and, under certain conditions, his grandchildren. But his current status, out of prison, but with severe restrictions on his freedom, is taking a toll.
You know, it's hard for him just to become a grandfather at home because he's actually not fully home yet. If you look at the big picture of it, we can't go to them in Vermont. We can't play with the grandchildren over there. We can't go to a Thanksgiving dinner over there or Easter dinner.
Amir also suffers from PTSD as a result of his decades in prison.
So sometimes he's got to take a step back because it's too overwhelming. He'll just sit there and sometimes stare. You know, I don't even know what's going on in his mind. And what does it look like throughout the night? He fights, he yells. He's got a lot of, you know, things that happen to him in the sleep. And we're still learning how to control that. He's still in his back of his mind, is not released from this hold that's on him. It's rough sometimes, but I love him. He doesn't mean me any harm. Here's a man that wouldn't hurt a friggin' fly. We had one incident where it was a little rough, And oh my God, did he cry and cry and cry. And it was something that we got through. And it's something we continue to get through.
In 2020, Arthur Larkin learned about Amir through Jeffrey Deskovic, an exoneree who, upon his release, started a foundation to look into other cases of wrongful conviction.
And he took letters from people all over the country who alleged that they were wrongfully convicted. And this is one case that he and I started working on a couple of years ago.
So what was it about this case? You know, on its face, it does seem like this was a guy who was found next to a body, kind of wrong place, wrong time. So what was it about this that you were like, you know, I think this guy might be innocent?
I think it's a good point you're making, because a lot of these cases, when you first look at them, you think, okay, you know, this guy's saying he's innocent, knock me over with a feather. You know, you were at the scene, you were found leaning over the body according to your version of events at a minimum. So there's no question you were there. What happened here? And when I started digging into the facts of the case and looking at some of the police reports in the case, you know, bit by bit, my confidence in the conviction was chipped away. And the kicker for me was the information about the knife, which was the alleged murder weapon.
In 2019, Paula Parrish, a caseworker for the Deskovic Foundation, filed a Freedom of Information Law request to review the Nyack police records from Amir's case.
And in this box of documents is a lot of information, a lot of stuff that was never turned over to the defense. The first document is an investigation memorandum prepared by an investigator, James Stewart, who was a DA investigator at the time.
And so what does this memo say?
The memorandum says that in August 1979, investigator Stewart and a Nyack detective went to the Bronx Terminal Market, and they interviewed a security supervisor who told them that, to his knowledge, the Bronx Terminal Market does not sell knives. Which means that Joe Lenti's story about buying knives at the Bronx Terminal Market and selling one to Amir Zeta was highly suspect.
So why would Lenti lie?
Lenti would lie because he was under investigation at the time for selling drugs in Nyack. And in July of 1979, about a month after he gave his statement, he was arrested and charged in a federal case. He was arrested by the Nyack police, working in conjunction with the FBI, and he was charged with federal drug crimes. He was indicted, and he was allowed to plead guilty and got a sentence of probation. All the other defendants in that drug case went to prison, all of them who were convicted, except for Joe Lenti. He only got probation.
The information that Lenti could not have bought the knives at the Bronx Terminal Market was never turned over to the defense. Withholding evidence from the defense is known as a Brady violation. And not only that,
the reports of the two officers who supposedly found the knife, their daily activity reports were never turned over to the defense. Now we've seen them. They're full of crossouts and strikeouts. They suggest that they were both at this garage at different times. They weren't there at the same time as they said they were at trial.
So that would be another Brady violation?
Yes, that would clearly be a Brady violation, in my view. Absolutely. But the jury did not know the information about the knife. And I think that if the jury had known that the police made up a story and testified inaccurately, if not outright falsely, about investigating the source of that knife, and that the testimony was intended to cover up the fact that there was a witness out there who could have said that they didn't sell knives at the Bronx Terminal Market, it would have called into question the whole story of how is it that this knife got into the backseat of the car?
All of this points to police and prosecutorial misconduct, which in itself is basis for a new trial. But when they took a deeper dive into those recovered police documents, the team uncovered further evidence that could prove even more significant.
We did make another FOIL Freedom of Information Law request to a different agency within Rockland County known as the Bureau of Criminal Identification. And one of the things that that agency does is process crime scenes. So we requested everything that they had on this case, and we got over 100 photographs, as well as additional reports and summaries of what the investigators found that morning when they came to the crime scene after the crime had occurred.
Arthur and his team showed those photographs to a renowned crime reconstruction expert, Brent Turvey.
So one of the conclusions he drew after looking at all the photos is that the victim was transported within the parking lot inside of a car. You can see blood spatter on one end of the parking lot, and then you see the victim's body is found on the other end of the parking lot, and there was a large blood stain close to where the victim was apparently thrown out of a car and then dragged behind the dumpster. But in between those two areas, there's no blood spatter, and you'd naturally expect a lot of blood inside the car where that victim was transported. Amir Zeta's car, as you know, was found near the crime scene. It was not drivable, it had broken down, and there was not a drop of blood in the car. So clearly, Amir's car was not used in this crime. That's point number one. Point number two is he looked closely at the photos of the knife that was alleged to be the murder weapon.
Remember, this is the knife that the two policemen said they found in the patrol car days after the crime.
He said clearly that knife was not used in this crime because if it had been, it would have had a lot more blood on it than it did. The thing would have been full of blood if it had been used to stab this woman 26 times.
Arthur believes this new evidence, along with a number of other conclusions Turvey drew from the crime scene photos, is a game changer for Amir's case.
What we have now is affirmative evidence that Amir had nothing to do with this. And so we've asked the court to hold a hearing on a claim of actual innocence, that Amir is actually innocent of the crime. And I really think the court should take a very hard look at everything we've presented. I really do think this is a compelling case of a miscarriage of justice. And I hope the court agrees with us.
But for now, until he's fully exonerated, Amir's life is still on hold.
I want to go on with my life and be able to live my life like a human being, not like a trapped animal that parole has me, like, you know, caged up as. I want to be able to go to water parks and amusement parks with my grandkids. I am not allowed to go anywhere with its children. I mean, they're just like, really, they literally have me designated as being an animal, a monster.
What does that feel like emotionally to be called these things, a murderer, a rapist, and you're none of those? What is that like?
I mean, it breaks my heart. I see it in the look that people give me when they look at me, like I'm an animal. And I've never done anything to anybody in my life in a cruel way. My mother and father raised me right. They were beautiful people. I want people to know. I want them to know the truth. I want my mother and father to finally be able to rest in peace. I don't want this to be the legacy that I leave behind for my children and my grandchildren.
We want it all to come to an end. We haven't started living again, Maggie. You know, and that's where we need to get at.
Amir and Bonnie are planning to remarry when the time is right, she says, when all of this is behind them.
I envision us like getting married next to the ocean, us being dressed in attire that we dressed in the 70s, like me in this beautiful white, easygoing dress with some flowers in my hair. And I envision him in white khakis and, you know, a shirt from that time period. I do envision good things, and I envision all our kids with us.
What beach do you think? Is there a place that you like?
I would say down at the shore. We used to spend a lot of time down at the shore, Seaside Heights, that area. Those were our stomping grounds. Yeah, we both miss the shore.
If you'd like to support the work of the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice, please go to the link in the episode description. And we'll also have a link to Amir's GoFundMe campaign to help support him in his new life. Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in the episode description to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our executive producers, Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, and Kevin Wirtis, as well as senior producer Annie Chelsea, producer Kathleen Fink, story editor Hannah Beal, and researcher Shelby Sorrells. Mixing and sound design are by Jackie Pauly, with additional production by Jeff Clyburn and Connor Hall. The music in this production is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on all platforms at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good podcasts in association with Signal Company Number One.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
iHeart Podcast Update, this week on your free iHeartRadio app.
In retrospect, revisit pop culture moments from the 80s and 90s and try to understand what it taught us about the world and a woman's place in it. Crying in public, 2 20-something college women living in NYC dive into growing up at a time when there was no distinction between what's public and what's private. Best of Both Worlds, a discussion on work-life balance, career development, parenting, time management, productivity, and making time for fun.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.